Hey, welcome along. This is Mark Stein, and it is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time on a Wednesday afternoon, 5 p.m. in the Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. in beautiful Newfoundland, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 10 p.m. in Western Europe, 11 p.m. in Cairo, Jerusalem, midnight in Moscow, midnight 30 in Tehran. Because those wacky Ayatollahs, I believe Iran was originally settled by Newfoundlanders, and that's why they also have the half-hour time zone over there. And wherever else you are beyond Tehran, it's Thursday morning, either a very antisocial hour or something, which it is in Perth, for example, Western Australia. But in Eastern Australia, you should be up and about by now and listening to our Clubland Q&A, and we look forward to your questions. It's already tomorrow in Australia, as we noted, and New Zealand. They may already know the results of the United Kingdom general election, which will be held tomorrow. They had a rather strange day of it for a final day of campaigning. Boris Johnson's press secretary used the F word live on television, and Boris himself then walked into a large refrigerator, prompting the usual. He didn't walk into it. He opened the door and went inside it. It's like some Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe thing. It's the way to Narnia, a magical land where there is no Irish backstop. I'll give you my thoughts on that if you want to ask any questions about that. Also, impeachment this week. People say to me, well, last time round you did in the 1990s, you did a big daily impeachment diary. Why aren't you doing it this time around? Because they've defined impeachment down. And as Tucker always says, it's a good line and it has the additional merit, as they used to say, as those of a Nixonian bent will recognise, it has the additional merit of being true, that what the left accused the right of, the left is doing itself. So, for example, this idea of Trump is interfering, is trying to get Ukraine to interfere in the 2020 election, just as he tried to get Russia to interfere in the 2016 election. There's been no evidence of that. But it goes beyond that, because you couldn't actually think of a bigger interference in a general election than for the ruling party to investigate and spy on its political opposition, which is what the Obama administration at the highest level, and by highest, I mean a man whose first name begins with B and whose second name begins with O, at the highest level, basically surveilling its political opposition, which is what happened in 2016. Now you can think of any greater interference in an election than, say, impeaching a guy even as primary season is beginning. You know, primary season, and everything takes forever in America. Land of sloth, republic of lethargy, including these two-year election campaigns. But one of the great merits of those two-year election campaigns is that people are always voting. So people will begin voting in the 2020 election in the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary in just a few weeks' time. And yet we are seeing interference in the election by an attempt to tar and discredit one of the two candidates by ensuring that he is under investigation for impeachment, for politically motivated impeachment. I can't tell you. I'll tell you something else. You know, a lot of my friends in talk radio getting all excited about, you know, that someday the justice will come and these vile, evil men, Brennan, Clapper, Comey, McCabe, Strzok and his paramour, that one day they will get what's coming to them. They'll get theirs, as I believe the vernacular expression is. Dream on. We were all supposed to get excited about the Inspector General's report, which is basically factually found everything that the right has been talking about. They've been proved right. So we've got CNN walking back some big scoop of theirs from a while back because the Inspector General has, you know, put in black and white that that's just rubbish. But there's going to be no... The Inspector General will say, oh, yeah, they did this and they shouldn't have, and they did that and they shouldn't have, and they shouldn't have done this and they shouldn't have done that, and blah, 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 blah. And nothing's going to happen to us. So everyone's like, whoa, whoa. So the same people who were saying on your talk radio, oh, wait till the Inspector General's report, wait till the Inspector General's report. Now say, never mind the Inspector General's report. Wait till this guy Durham, till his report. And then all these people will get what's coming to them. Yeah, dream on, dream on. It's not very difficult. It's not very difficult. If you're in the club, nothing happens. If you're not in the club, like Paul Manafort, Roger Stone, Papadopoulos, you can watch my interview with Papadopoulos. He went to jail for nothing. Roger Stone is someone who is basically, he's a gadfly who spent his life cocking a snook at all the big shots in the club for the last half century. And the big shots have finally got him, and he's going to die in prison. This I use the word evil, which is not a word I use lightly, but America's so-called federal so-called justice system is evil. Evil. So Roger Stone is going to die in jail for nothing, while all these people who subverted the very... one of the most basic defining characteristics of any free society, which is to have a free and fair election. And they turned it into full-blown banana republic territory. You can read this Inspector General, who's just another wanker in the club. But the Inspector General makes it plain that everybody knew the dodgy dossier, or whatever you call it, from Christopher Steele was rubbish from the beginning. And yet they used it as the Hitchcockian MacGuffin as a pretext to spy on their political opponents. And none of them will pay the price because they're in the club and Roger Stone isn't. That's my line on that rubbish. If you want to ask me a question, you can ask me a question. But I think this is evil. And at some point, while I'm just getting worked up a bit here, at some point, regular people, I've often joked that if you're targeted by the federal government, I'll just drive down to the First National Bank of whatever, wherever your checking account is kept, clear out the $300 in there. I'll throw you into the back of the pickup, toss a tarp over you and drive you over the Canadian border, because that's quicker than just being tormented by an evil system that wins 97% of its cases without going to court and which will drain your savings in that. So, you know, General Flynn, he was sort of in the club because he was a general. Thank you for your service, as they always say. Thank you for your service. And now we're going to drain all the money, the little money you've made from your decades of service. We're going to take all that and you'll be going to prison. Because you sort of were in the club, but now you got mixed up with Trump, so you're now not in the club. This is an evil system that should command no respect. I said, what can you do about this? I think this is a joke, and I think I think some of these pansies on the right, I listened to some of these talk radio guys explaining about this statute and that statute. What the hell planet are you living on? It doesn't matter. If you're in the club, you skate. If you're not in the club, you die in jail, like Roger Stone. Why some of these butch right-wing talk show hosts need to butch up a lot more about this? I was up in Quebec yesterday, and they're all annoyed on the talk radio. They're up there. They're all getting a bit annoyed because the Quebec government is concerned that too many kids are opting out of sex education. And 270 kids in the province have opted out of sex education because their parents don't like it. And people were discussing this on the radio. And in the Outaouais, in one school district, 200 of these 270 kids are in the Outaouais. So they're all thinking that's suspicious. It doesn't mean anything else. It doesn't mean any more than that the parents in the Outaouais started paying attention and got organized. And it's time that people on the right got organized about the fundamental, instead of saying, oh no, yeah, we got screwed over this time, but the Inspector General's report is coming. Oh, well, no, he screwed us over too. Oh, well, don't worry about it because the Durham report is coming. Yeah, bet on that, suckers. Bet on that, suckers, one more time. You know, you need to do what those parents in the Outaouais did, organise, and actually, we actually need to bring this filthy, evil, federal lack of equality before the law. Lack of equality before the law, which means there is no law. You're not a land of laws. You're a land of men. And we need to bring that crashing down. Gary from Lower Slower Delaware, as he always says, writes, Mark, a twofer. How do you see the British election tomorrow? How do you see the schmozzle here in the US with the impeachment? You've called it the impeachment. That's as good as anything. I think I've said I had my say on the impeachment. I may call it the impeachment from now on. The British election tomorrow. The polls have tightened considerably, as they say. A couple of weeks back, it looked like my old friend Boris was on course for a 68-seat majority in the House of Commons. It's now slid on the most recent polls to 28, which puts it in margin of error. If you take the margin of error into account, we could be looking at a hung parliament. And you'd only really need a few hundred votes to go differently from the polls in this constituency and that constituency, and you would certainly be in minority polling territory. For example, nationally, there's been a collapse in the Brexit Party's support, down to 3%. But Ross Clark in The Spectator was writing today that if you go constituency by constituency, in the Labour Party constituencies that Boris and the Tories were targeting in the north of England, where basically the constituencies voted for Brexit, they're Labour constituencies that voted for Brexit. And the Brexit Party's share of the vote there in those constituencies is about 20%. Which means basically that Labour Party voters who've soured on Labour can't quite bring themselves to vote Tory, because that's a tribal thing. It's like if you're in Quebec, if you're in parts of rural Quebec, the Liberal Party of Quebec, there's parts of Quebec where there's secessionist families, separatist families, nationalist families who just can never bring themselves to vote for the Liberal Party of Quebec. That's just the thing. And something similar seems to be happening. The trouble is, if things like that work against the Tories and we're in minority territory, Jeremy Corbyn, as unlovely as he is, and we'll get to that a bit later too, the old Jew hater, Jeremy Corbyn has friends everywhere as he surveys a United Kingdom he doesn't actually recognise. He nevertheless has friends in every corner of the kingdom. In other words, the Scottish nationalists would support him. The Lib Dems would support him. Some of these, the nationalist constituencies in Northern Ireland would support him. So we're in very dodgy territory, and Boris has fought both of them. Jeremy Corbyn can't be interviewed because it's not anti-Semitism. Then it's not that. It's not. We're not talking about the Labour Party having people who think that Jews shouldn't be members of your country club. We're talking about people who seriously hate Jews and want Jewish life expunged from the United Kingdom, and that's. It's not anti-Semitism. In that sense, becomes a euphemism. And so he can't go on TV and be interviewed because the interviewers persist in bringing this stuff up, even though it doesn't move the meter on the polls. Because actually now you might lose a few old-time lefty Jews in Golders Green. You might lose seven of them if you're exposed as a Jew hater. But on the other hand, you might pick up an awful lot of votes in Bradford and parts of the East End of London. It's odd that. I wonder why that could be. And Boris doesn't want to go on TV for a whole variety of other reasons, because his Brexit is... doesn't really, his so-called Brexit, get Brexit done, his Brexit is not a good Brexit for the sovereignty of the United Kingdom. Oh, well, here we go. Ben Poser from Boston, Massachusetts, says, Dear Mark, Even though Mr. Corbyn, at least at this moment, doesn't seem to have a chance of becoming Prime Minister. Do you foresee that he could get his chance regardless of what happens with Brexit in the foreseeable future? I'm not sure about that. I think if he loses, then there will be moves against him in the British Labour Party. This guy, Keir Starmer, and others will be anxious to dump Corbyn. But just to emphasise the point I made, when you say he doesn't seem to have a chance of becoming Prime Minister, that's if you just look at his and the Labour Party's numbers. And what I think you can make a general point too, that as this election has gone on, although Boris looked to be doing quite well in preventing Tory voters abandoning him for the Brexit Party, but at the same time, Labour, far more consequentially in terms of what constituencies are up for grabs, has done a much better job of, as the weeks have gone by, of pulling back Labour voters who were thinking of going to the Liberal Democrats, who are the most open party about actually wanting to reverse Brexit. And so Labour's own numbers aren't as bad as they should be, especially given what's come out about the Jew hate. But at the same time, that's less relevant than the fact that there are whole swathes of the map where Jeremy Corbyn, basically no one, the Tories only had a majority with Theresa May because of Arlene and her dear old Democratic unionists in Northern Ireland. And Arlene, much as I like her, has actually been sort of tied in knots by the Brexit deal that Boris did and which she doesn't support. So in other words, the Tories' last friend, the Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, has jumped ship and doesn't want to know them. So basically, there's one party that's got no friends, that's the Tories, and then there's another party that's got friends in every corner of the realm, and that's Jeremy Corbyn's ghastly lot. I think there's a poll, Ben Poser continues, I think there's a poll which says that around half of British Jews will flee the country if he ever gets to Downing Street. Even if Brexit does happen, that doesn't mean this despicable Labour Party is history. You're right on that, Ben. One of the interesting developments about this that happened here is my old friend Maureen Lipman, who Maureen had national treasure status in the United Kingdom in the 1970s because she made a famous telephone commercial, I think for British Telecom, and in which she's like a Jewish grandmother who's proud because her grandson has got an ology. As it were, sociology or whatever the kid was doing, or whatever. She's proud because, like, she's a Jewish grandmother proud because her grandson has gone to school and got an ology. And she did a parody. And at that point, that was the most beloved commercial in the United Kingdom 40 years ago. And Maureen wasn't a grandmother. She was a vibrant young woman, well, a vibrant woman in her prime, delightful and everybody loved that commercial. Everybody loved that ad. And what has happened? And she comes from a long line of Labour lefties. She was married to Jack Rosenthal, who I knew mainly because every so often he'd get involved in a musical, have a disastrous time, and then want to bitch and moan about how much he hated musicals. He was a very talented playwright, lovely man. And they were like very typical British Jews, fully assimilated British Jews. And like most British Jews, like most American Jews, like most Canadian Jews, they were lefties. And Jack died a couple of years ago, and Maureen continued to support the Labour Party and has finally abandoned the Labour Party and this time round did a parody of her famous British Telecom commercial from the 70s. She's now the age, more or less, of the grandmother she played back then, and she's doing a parody on that of that call about what the anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. But you know, the thing about it is, it's too late. Jeremy Corbyn, and so when you talk about a despicable Labour Party, democratic politics are defined by demography as much as anything else. Jeremy Corbyn hasn't backed down off the anti-Semitism thing, off the Jew hate thing, because he's 24 hours out. Tomorrow morning, people are going to be going to the polls. And actually, not to put too crude and vile a point on it, but there are now certain constituencies in parts of southern and western Yorkshire, for example, parts of Lancashire, parts of the West Midlands, parts of the East End of London, where being perceived to hate Jews actually gins up the party base there. Mentioning no particular names, you know. We're not saying anything. We don't want to mention any of those problematic words beginning with I or M that Kate Smythe was talking about. But in fact, he made a rational demographic calculation that if you look at who votes Labour, if you look at a core element of Labour's base, it's Islam. We're not even talking about terrorism. We're not even talking about Sharia. We're talking just about something that is perfectly obvious to anyone who's spent 10 minutes in Cairo, 10 minutes in Amman, 10 minutes in Saudi, 10 minutes in Emirates, and it's actually pretty consistent across hardcore Islam and moderate Islam. They're antipathetic to Jews. The fact that the Labour Party is perceived as hostile to Jews is actually good for the base. In the general election. Toby Pilling writes, do you think that in Britain and elsewhere, the young will eventually have to vote in and experience a socialist government for them to finally understand what the rest of us have been warning them about? No, everyone thinks that, you know, people think that if people experience, everyone thinks you go straight to Venezuela, that suddenly you're having to, there's no toilet paper and there's nothing to eat but the family dog. And it doesn't work like that. You can live on the nations in decline can live in decline quite enjoyably on the accumulated capital of the period before they were in decline. That's one reason why you have the politics that you have, because that's politics in that, in a certain sense, is a lagging indicator. You can have a situation where today most college students in America think socialism is a good thing. They've never experienced it. You could elect Bernie, and Bernie might horrify constitutional conservatives and all kinds of other people, but the kids would enjoy it and think they'd voted right. And they'd vote to re-elect him 4 years later, unless something goes really south. Like, Carter would have been re-elected if it weren't for the malaise, basically caused by OPEC on oil prices, and by the Iranian hostages thing. Otherwise, Carter would have had a second term and we'd have lost the Cold War. So I don't think, if you're saying that a Labour government, Toby, which would require Liberal Democrat support and all kinds of other, it would lead to a second referendum on Brexit and a second independence referendum in Scotland. And at that point, you know, there'd be so many other things going on that the hardcore socialism might not actually be the thing that people were focused on. Owen Morgan writes, in Britain we go to the polls tomorrow and to the dogs the day afterwards if Jeremy Corbyn gets anywhere near power. Since Corbyn is desperate for Remainers votes, he has implied that he will ditch Brexit and he'll probably apply to join the Russian Federation or maybe Venezuela. Meanwhile, in the United States just the other day, two Hillary groupies were coming up with yet more excuses for why she lost but didn't lose really. Is this actually what electoral cycle means now? An event without any discernible start or finish, with the voting just an inconsequential or inconvenient punctuation marks somewhere along the way. Yeah, I think it's not unreasonable to say that. For example, if you vote, I talked about the club, about people like Comey and Brennan and Clapper, all these vile, evil men being in the club, and someone, a gadfly like Roger Stone or a youngster like Papadopoulos not being in the club. And I think that's true with your electoral choices, that people, particularly the permanent bureaucracy, has got used to the way that you hold an election, and sometimes the party that's in favour of big government wins, and sometimes the party that's nominally opposed to big government wins, like the GOP or the Andrew Scheer squish-type Tories in Canada, or, you know, a Theresa May-type so-called conservative party. I mean, I hardly even like, we might as well, the word is, it's killing the word, having people like Theresa May and Andrew Scheer associated with it, be that as it may. The job of those parties is just to sort of, as I said, it's like the first-year boys who warm the toilet seats for prefects at chilly English boarding schools. The job of the so-called right-wing party is not to fundamentally change anything, but just to keep the seat warm until the party of the left resumes its rightful place. And they're getting ever more comfortable now with nullifying the result of the election. So, for example, one reason why Hillary can get away with saying that she really won the election is because her party has basically obstructed and prevented Trump from enjoying his mandate since November 2016. Same thing in Britain, where people voted for Brexit, and then an anti-Brexit parliament, an anti-Brexit media, an anti-Brexit judiciary have all done their best to object to it. Now, certain raw forms of democracy, as we see in continental Europe, they actually go ahead and elect these parties, and these parties are serious about carrying out their mandate, as Viktor Orban does in Hungary, or actually moving further west in Austria and Italy. And at that point, the European Commission steps in, and the guys in Brussels are the ones who screw you over. But it is becoming, we are on the brink, I think. It's interesting to me. I talked about with Jeremy Corbyn, that is the reality of democracy, that if you import large numbers of people who are antipathetic to Jews, eventually that will reflect itself in the public stance of those parties. And it's a horrible thing. I'm just like trying to talk about it as unemotionally as possible, because I think it's one of the great tragedies. Britain, you know, by the standards of continental Europe, has a pretty good track record on these things. British Jews always thought of themselves as assimilated because they were assimilated at the highest levels. I've talked before, the Marquess of Reading, for example. He was a Jew raised to a marquessate and made Viceroy of India. Now, you think about that. You think about that. India has more Muslims than any other country on earth. And the British put a Jew in as viceroy, because they were that wasn't thought of as a big deal back then. I mean, it's historically significant. It's when there was some terrorist thing or whatever happened in Pakistan, and they took all these Muslims to be patched up, the Muslim victims of this attack. They took them to be patched up at Lady Reading Hospital, named for the Marchioness. And so, as I said, Britain has a better track record on this thing than now, because you're culturally confident that back time. You can say, well, a lot of the Muslims, I don't know whether we should, now they say, I don't know whether we should make a Jew Viceroy of India, because it might upset some of the Muslims. In those days, they just went ahead and did it because they thought, they were culturally confident to demand that India operate to British norms throughout the empire, and that meant that the Marquess of Reading could go and be India's first Jewish viceroy. So it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy what is happening here on this issue. But my point here is that in a democratic society, if you import a bunch of Jew haters, you'll have Jew-hating political parties. The interesting thing to me, then, is that we have this other trend, which we see manifested in the state's attitude to Trump, the state's attitude to Brexit, the European superstate's attitude to Austria, Italy, Hungary, or whatever, where they're ever more comfortable in moving into a post-democratic age, which is interesting to me. Todd Williamson says, "Dear Mark, it seems to me that the Democrats have painted themselves into a corner with their efforts to impeach Trump. I don't see any way this could end without the Dems suffering mightily in November 2020. Your thoughts? Also, have you ever had any live gigs in the Atlanta area? We'd love to see you down here sometime. Thanks a bunch," says Todd. I've been in Atlanta a few times over the years, but I don't think I've ever done a live engagement there, and I'd quite like to. I always like that song Peachtree Street, co-written by Frank Sinatra, and he and Rosie Clooney made a lovely record of it. So maybe we'll book a theatre and I'll come and sing Peachtree Street to you and your fellow Georgians. What was the thing about? Oh, impeachment, yeah. Impeachment on Peachtree Street. Ah, why didn't they change that to Impeachtree Street? That would be a lovely name, wouldn't it? Anyway, peaches are from Georgia. Impeachments are... Who is going... This is going to be one of these things where... I think it's going nowhere. And I think one of the interesting things about that is that even the base is not enthused. I mentioned this sort of in passing. I was crowing about how I beat Rachel Maddow and co. all hollow when I guest host at Fox. There was a point after Trump was elected when Rachel Maddow and her Fox and her MSNBC co-hosts were a serious threat to Fox. They won a lot of the time. Rachel Maddow would push Sean Hannity into second place. A lot of the time, she'd have the second number two show. She'd beat Tucker and she'd beat Laura Ingraham and all the rest of it. She'd beat them in the demo, so called, which is the 25-54. Because as we're always being told, younger people are far more liberal, are far more Democrat, are far more progressive, whatever you want to call it. In fact, now, like yours truly the other night, we dead white males on Fox win the demo too. So it's interesting that impeachment isn't resonating with the base. It's like there's been no, if it meant anything, you would see it in Rachel Maddow's numbers. She's not winning. She's come in like five or six. She's come in below the big Fox All-Star lineup. She loses to me when I guest host, right? So that's telling me that there is actually no discernible benefit, even among the hardcore base, which is why they're desperate, which is why they're using this sad, pathetic man reduced to attacking his own wife all day long on Twitter, this twerp, George Conway, which is why they're suddenly all palsy-walsy with him and retweeting him and interviewing him on MSNBC and CNN. They're going nowhere. Now, there's two reasons for this, which is that I think, actually, the left-wing, the hardcore, for start, in those swing states, the other thing, just quickly to note, in those swing states, the numbers, the polls have all swung back to Trump. So they show that Trump would beat Joe Biden, would beat Bernie, would beat Elizabeth Warren in those things. And if they can't take those states back, the Democrats lose. Then you look at where the energy is. The AOC crowd aren't into impeachment. They don't want some little show trial for Trump. They're serious socialists, and they want hardcore socialist policies. And that's actually like a lot of the base too. So even even the base can't get interested in what Trump did or did not do with military aid to Ukraine, which is one of those things for which there's no correct answer. You know, oh, Trump held up military aid for Ukraine. Really? Well, I'm like a left-wing guy, and I don't really support military aid for... We should give all the military aid for transgender treatment. Yeah, so we shouldn't have all the military aid. It's not going anywhere. It's just a disaster for them. And they managed to put in charge of it people who really, if you were concerned, if you wanted to up your numbers, you wouldn't have Jerry Nadler on TV. These ancient guys falling asleep on live television, having to be, when somebody on the Republican side attempts to move a point of order, they have to have it explained to them why it's not a valid point of order. It's pathetic. It makes the whole... That's another thing. I can't stand these... I'm sick of hearings. Sick of hearings. These guys shouldn't hold... To hell with hearings. It's a whole waste of time, all that. It's rubbish, all of it. What else we got here? Drew says, Dems and media constantly rely on exaggeration or lies when hurling charges at Trump. So the charge of racism requires ignoring Trump's words explicitly condemning racists at Charlottesville, and more recently, Schiff's so-called parodic summary of Trump's phone call with the Ukrainian president was deemed necessary rather than state the text of the call. The list could go on. If the criticism were true, they would simply have to state the facts, but they can't. The question I often pose to Trump's critics is to name instances where his actions and policies hurt the American people. Usually the sound of crickets are louder. Your thoughts? Well, you're quite right there, Drew. Again, it's the Tucker thing. They always accuse the right. The left always accuses the right of what they do themselves. The only quid pro quo anyone's got on tape is Joe Biden, the corrupt sleazebag Joe Biden, who's got the world's most useless, you know, everyone talks about Hunter Biden. Oh, it's so unfair for Trump to pick on Hunter, like she's Greta Thunberg's age. Like Greta and Hunter, there may be, wouldn't that be the dream couple? Because there's little 9-year-old Greta and 12-year-old Hunter. Wouldn't it be nice if they got together and bred some fantastic Biden-Thunberg dynasty? And in fact, Hunter is like some middle-aged guy. He's 50 years old, but we talk about him as if he's Greta. It's so unfair of Trump to beat up on little Greta Biden Thunberg there. Little child. That's not really fair game. And the fact is, that's the only quid pro quo there is, where he's on video saying, hey, I told those Ukrainian losers. I said, listen, you got 6 hours till I'm out of here. I'm just like going to go back to my hotel. I'm going to freshen up, maybe get a massage and a facial, call up room service. Then I'm headed to the airport. 6 hours. You don't get the money unless you fire that prosecutor. And son of a bee, as they say on the radio and TV. But because he's Biden, he likes to show how tough he is by talking dirty, working blue. Biden says, and son of a bitch, the prosecutor got fired. I don't even necessarily, it may not even be that they fired the prosecutor for Biden, but he's so insecure about his masculinity that he feels he has to say, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, and boast about having the prosecutor fired. That's it. Where's the Trump version of that? Where's that? Why don't they do a photo? Since Adam Schiff is the master parodist, why doesn't he just Photoshop Trump's head onto Biden's body in that video? And you'd have your quid pro quo. Brian from Minneapolis with the impeachment hearings. Before we get to Brian, Drew, the other thing. The question you say is to name instances where his actions and policies hurt the American people. That's why Trump got elected. And that's why people who, you know, talk about corporate gains tax and corporate tax and that kind of thing capital gains, all that, are missing the point. Trump was elected because the American people in key districts were hurting. And Trump come, you know, everyone, as I made the point, I wrote this in June of 2015, 4.5 years ago, that Trump was the first person in the Republican field, forget the Democrats, to talk about immigration from the point of view of the people who are already here. Because that's how you're meant to talk about it. Until we moved into nutso land, governments across the world discussed immigration in terms of the needs of the people who are already there. So if you're short 300 bus drivers, you have an immigration policy that allows you to hire 300 bus drivers to drive those buses. But that is because otherwise the people who are already there would be waiting at the bus stop for a bus that would never come. It was like any other public policy. It was intended to benefit the citizens for whom you are responsible. And when the Republican primary started in 2015, we had all these sentimental twits like Jeb Bush and the rest of them talking about immigration the same way Democrats talk about immigration, about how wonderful all these immigrants are, and if we could just somehow come with up with a comprehensive immigration reform to bring them out of the shadows, because family values don't stop at the Rio Grande, stop me before I fall asleep and into a huge coma. Trump was the only one who said, well, what the hell are you talking about? We don't talk about immigration from the point of view of the immigrants. We talk about the immigration from the point of view of the people who are already here. That's why he won. And that's still what gets the loudest cheers at these rallies. And when he starts talking about the big, beautiful door, it's interesting to me. Sometimes he gets carried away. And he's too cocooned in Washington by people trying to subvert him. And so he goes to some rally in the middle of wherever, and he starts talking about how he'll have a big, beautiful door and he wants more H-1B visas. And the crowd sit on their hands. They want him to remember that he's president because he thought that immigration, he argued that immigration, like any other public policy, should be in the interests of the people who are already here. Brian from Minneapolis says, "Dear Mark, with the impeachment hearings being a complete farce and now moving forward, it's clear the Dems want to say that the 2016 election and the soon-to-be 2020 election will be illegitimate because of Russian interference. We all knew that impeachment was never going to go through, but maybe the goal was to show that the system no longer will work for the people and needs to be removed. You said in your post, Populism versus Post-Democracy, that the ruling class is teaching us that no matter how you vote, nothing is going to change. It now seems more and more that our ruling class plans on only allowing vetted candidates that they approve to be able to run for office, be it a far-left socialist or a rhino like Paul Ryan. In the end, no matter who you vote for, the establishment remains in charge. I worry that the electoral system as we know it has and will forever be changed and not for the better. Your thoughts, Mark?" I think that's right. They think that if you keep telling them in Brexit or in, well, ideally the system would be like what they have in Canada, where you shame a so-called, to read about Andrew Scheer, you'd think he was this hardcore principled social conservative. He's not. He's just like a gutless twerp who believes in nothing and is sitting there like a puppy begging for treats from the Canadian media. And the idea being to neuter and spay that puppy so that even if he were elected, nothing would change. And what's interesting is that the Republicans voters in 2016 and Brexit voters in 2016 both said to hell with that. Since then, the establishment has spent a long time trying to get into the ingrate voters' heads that they're not to do anything like that again. Now, for example, here, they're impeaching Trump. They're going to impeach Trump in an election year. This is what they're going to do. There's going to be some kind of trial of the president in the Senate, even as people are voting in Iowa and New Hampshire. And so let's just game that out a bit. So the president will be, there's two scenarios. The president will be impeached, but he will beat the rap in the Senate and not be removed. Or, you know, who knows how it could go? I mean, there's really no bottom to the duplicitousness of someone like Mitt Romney. That's an old word that they used to say about the Tories. Does he have bottom? Meaning, is he a substantial man? But it has another meaning when it comes to Mitt Romney. As I said, there's no end to the duplicity here. So it's not inconceivable that in certain circumstances, Mitt might join Democrats in voting to impeach Trump and whatever, or voting to remove Trump. So you'd have then a situation, pitch it on a few months later, where they'd be saying, oh, well, either the impeachment or whatever the Senate trial, let's not deal with removal from office, although that one shouldn't rule that out once these things get going. But let's say he's impeached and then acquitted in the Senate. And people would say then, well, has he no shame? Why is he even running? He ought to at least, he's been impeached. He just hasn't been convicted and removed. But the impeachment alone should drive any man with a sense of shame to withdraw from the race and let Mike Pence go forward, or, you know, perhaps bring in someone more moderate and sensible. Mitt Romney stands ready to step in. John Kasich stands ready to step in. Maybe Bob Dole's available. And at that point, the purpose of that will be, which they will run with in the months between impeachment and the election. If in that event Trump wins re-election in November, they will say, then they'll say, well, this just goes to show how much more sophisticated the Russian interference was this time round, because Trump was a totally discredited figure. He was impeached. The idea that an impeached president could then just simply stand for re-election and win is preposterous. So the Russians must have really interfered even more seriously than last time. So we'll just investigate him again for another 4 years. And you're teaching in free societies, it's very dangerous to teach the electorate that there are no peaceful means of changing course, because you're essentially setting up pre-revolutionary conditions. Peripatetic writes, quid pro quo. Robert Mueller is James Comey's boss at the FBI. Comey leaves the FBI and joins Lockheed Martin as senior vice president and general counsel. Comey gets stock options. LM, Lockheed Martin, gets a big contract from the FBI. Comey makes capital gains on his stock options, a.k.a. FU money. Comey rejoins the FBI as a wealthy man, and Comey slides up to run the FBI. Trump fires Comey. Mueller interviews with Trump as a candidate to replace Comey. Mueller is instead appointed witchfinder general, tasked to run the Trump Inquisition. Mueller gets 2 years of lucrative pay and headlines to attack Trump. Mueller jails four men to protect his informant, Massachusetts Democrat politician's brother, Whitey Bulger. Whitey Bulger gets incarcerated when he has no quo left to give. Whitey Bulger gets transferred to a new jail and is offed in hours when put into the general population of the jail. Whitey Bulger's nephew, the son of a Massachusetts Democrat senator, gets a slice of the Biden deal, etc., etc. Like I said, Perry, it's who's in the club and who isn't in the club. And to go back to a point I made, and I was mocked for this by certain persons who thought the comparison was irrelevant, but what kind of independent counsel, you know, I said that in all the systems I've ever spent any time in, you know, when you want somebody independent, they have to come from outside. Like in Northern Ireland over the commissioning of IRA weapons, decommissioning of IRA weapons, they brought in a Canadian general. Why? Because the IRA obviously wouldn't have wouldn't want a UK general. So you bring in someone from outside. Likewise, when they had the corruption thing in the Turks and Caicos, they fly in someone from London to clean the thing up, to investigate it. They flew in the Metropolitan Police to investigate the corruption, because if the issue is corruption in the Turks and Caicos, then the Turks and Caicos police aren't in a thing to. Then I'm just saying that's the way it works, and that's the way it should work. This was no pretense, even at an in. Oh yes, I got who? Who's my? We need an independent counsel. Oh great. So who's the independent counsel? James Comey's ex-boss, the most plugged-in Beltway insider there is, Robert Mueller. This is a joke. Why? Why does the right go along with it? And he was another guy. Do you remember when Robert Mueller? He's a Boy Scout. Like they used to say that of Comey when he was investigating Hillary. Oh, he's a boy. He's an Eagle Scout. He's a Boy Scout. He's a straight shooter, straight arrow, straight this, eagle that, eagle, eagle, straight, straight. How many times do you have to be sucker? And then they say when Comey's fired, they go, well, Robert Mueller, the independent counsel. Well, you know, he's got very good with straight shooter, straight arrow, Eagle Scout, Boy Scout, Boy Scout, Eagle Scout, straight arrow, straight shooter, straight scout, whatever. How many times do you have to be suckered by this? He's in the club and Trump's out of the club. That's how that's going to go. You know, it's crazy. The right, the American right, you know, they're very naive on a lot of these things. Janet Long writes, the climate alarmists seem to be winning with their coup in getting Time magazine to name their darling Greta Thunberg as person of the year. She will be let loose now to indoctrinate more young people if they haven't already been convinced by the education system that we are doomed. What say you, Mark? Do you know, the one thing I think about, I'm relatively relaxed about Greta Thunberg because you have to be a bit careful. You have to tiptoe. I keep calling her a nine-year-old girl, but I gather she's somewhat older. But she's sort of got up to look like Heidi or Anna Green Gables or whatever. She doesn't look like the average teenage girl you see these days. But I'm not, for a start, I have no desire. There's certain issues on which I recognize that I'm not in tune with the mass of humanity. But I certainly feel, I thought Greta Thunberg's appearance at the United Nations General Assembly when she did her how dare you thing. My first thing, I was completely repelled by that. Not because I particularly loathe her, but it's because it's clear about the rampant, that the social engineering on this issue has veered into child abuse of a certain kind, in that they've terrorized certain school children into thinking that we're all going to die. Which isn't going to happen. It's not going to happen. So when she's doing her how dare you thing, and when she then extends it not only into a critique of so-called climate deniers, but into a broader critique of actual capitalism, or indeed what one might call primary economic activity, because it's hard to think of anything more economically useless to the economy than, you know, Greta Thunberg and her family going around doing all this stuff. I don't think people are with her on that. And Time's Man of the Year or Woman of the Year or Person of the Year or Swedish Schoolgirl of the Year, whatever they're calling it now, Time's Man of the Year. It's not like when they put Hitler on the cover back in the good old days. Time magazine mattered then. It doesn't matter now, Time's Man of the Year. The only reason Time looks good is because it didn't have to be sold for a buck like Newsweek had. Time and Newsweek used to be rivals. Newsweek wound up getting sold for a dollar because nobody wanted it. That's not a dollar for a copy of the man. They sold it for, what does Newsweek cost now at the newsstands back then? $5.95, $3.95? They sold it for like a quarter or a third of a copy of the magazine. They just want to get out from there. Washington Post, I think, owned it then. Sold it for a buck. And now Newsweek is still a thing somewhere on the internet. They attack me every so often. And nobody cares because it's basically 12 pajama boys sitting in a basement somewhere. That's what Newsweek is. Time looks good because it hasn't been reduced to that pitiful status. But nobody cares about Time's Man of the Year, even if you make it a 9-year-old Swedish schoolgirl. So I think Greta Thunberg is one of those things where large numbers of people don't like her, but they're not comfortable about saying it's mean-spirited to beat up on a 9-year-old Swedish schoolgirl. So people just sort of bite their tongue. But I don't think actually the Greta Thunberg bandwagon is as big as people think it is. Richard Malaby writes, "Hi Mark, love the club. I'm giving up the 9-to-5 and going into business for myself. I'll be selling carbon credits to guilty white liberals. I should make a killing. And the best part is I don't need any sort of long-term business strategy, as in 10 years we'll all be dead." No, that's true. The other thing is you don't need a lot of inventory. The carbon credits take up very little space. You could basically just keep them in your bottom drawer when you're selling the carbon credits. I was checking in at Air Canada in Montreal a few years ago, and the lady asked me, I turned up and said, do you want to pay an extra $300 to make your flight carbon neutral? I said, what do you mean? She said, well, if you pay $300, your flight to London will be carbon neutral. I go, how does that work? She says, well, I don't really know, but it's just a promotion we're having. I go, well, it's not a promotion, though, is it? You're asking me to pay $300. It's not like I get an extra bottle of champagne and foie gras when I board or whatever. You're giving me $300 to make my flight carbon neutral. And you can't tell me what that is or in what way my giving you $300 makes the flight carbon neutral. And so I was like chuckling over that. She was a nice lady, very pleasant. I forget what the French for carbon credits is. Crédit de carbone. But the lady, then some guy comes in at the next desk and the lady there says, would you like to pay $300 to make your flight to London carbon neutral? He said, oh, certainly. Yes, that sounds excellent. So, Richard, you've got a great business model there. I wish you the best of luck. Laura Rosen-Cohen says, hi, Mark. What's with the Trump tweet that basically sounded like it came right from Saudi Arabia's propaganda ministry? When will this, our friends the Saudis, hooey, finally end? Yeah. This is in reference to the tweet that Trump put out after the ludicrous, absurd, pathetic death of three Americans, the murder of three Americans at the hands of a Saudi in the United States for flight training. It's a fabulous place, this naval base in Pensacola. It trained the Iranians in the 70s, the Iraqis in the 80s, trains the Saudis before 9/11. You know, I don't even get that. Again, I don't. America is a sovereign nation. It's not part of some club. I'm putting the British Empire at its mildest, but there's like a lot of people who still go to Sandhurst for military training from countries that are nominally independent or actually independent but are not in law foreign. I can see the point of that. I see absolutely no reason why pilots should be receiving military training in Pensacola unless they're American pilots, given the situation we're in. Again, either you take this 9/11 seriously. One of the sad things about 9/11, for example, is that the impositions, the burdens of it, of the attack, were imposed on the American people. As you see at the airport, if you're going to be flying home for Christmas, you'll know that. But they weren't imposed on foreigners. And it's very bizarre. We were talking about Northern Ireland briefly. You know, during that period, for example, the internal travel was restricted for certain persons within the United Kingdom. You could be someone who had not been convicted of a crime, but if you were thought to be involved with the IRA and you tried to book a shuttle from Belfast to Glasgow or Belfast to Liverpool, Belfast to Heathrow, the police would stop you boarding that plane. Because even in that pathetic so-called troubles, the state was serious about not losing and about not getting its citizens killed. And at the very least, we should be able to say, oh, yes, the Saudis, lots of them are very nice chaps, quite good, helps to have them learn how to fly the planes properly. But it's not something, given what happened on 9/11, where 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, a lot of them had been to flight training in the United States, including passing through this very facility. It's not something we should encourage. Now, I don't know what that means, Laura. I don't think it means anything good. I think I've got a perfect track record on this. 2002, I called for the breakup of Saudi Arabia. I'd rather see anything else there. I think it's a toxic state that almost everything it does is malign. Prince Turki Al-Faisal, a very sinister man, said Mark Stein, with the arrogance of Mark Stein knows no bounds, with one stroke of his imperialist pen, he would wipe my country off the map. And I thanked him for, you know, distilling my position so perfectly and pithily. This is not a society. The idea of Trump tweeting that the king of Saudi Arabia has assured him that the Saudi people love the American people. No, they don't. And the minimum that free societies should be able to expect is that their leaders don't tweet total bollocks. Scott Podner says, regarding the hero of the disarmed English population that fought the terrorists with the narwhal tusk, actually, I wonder if you expect any forthcoming legislation to punish him and prevent any further animal abuse of whales, fish, etc., and to convince any future victim to just accept his inevitable multicultural fate. Yeah, I think someone, there was a brief exchange in the comments section a couple of days ago. Someone had been in London and he'd been amused that people are greeting each other with the Christmas greeting, Joyeux Narwhal. And somebody responded, that's not really funny anymore. And it isn't funny anymore. Our rulers, both in Pensacola and at London Bridge, have decided that it's perfectly acceptable to sacrifice a certain number of us. And actually, we're just supposed to get used to it. And what's interesting to me is when this guy had a fake suicide belt, but nobody knew it was fake. It looked quite convincing. And these people, the people who rush toward the danger, and some of them are Poles, some of them appear to be what one might call ethnic English or legacy English, I suppose we should say. And they too rush towards the danger. Suicide belt, you think about that. Taking down a guy with a suicide belt. You don't know it's fake. And you think if he just lowers his thumb, you're going to be in a bazillion pieces. There won't even be anything left for your loved ones to identify. There won't be anything left to lower into any kind of coffin, and they'll just be pieces of you, blown over hundreds of yards. And yet those people, nevertheless, they saw that guy with what they thought was a suicide belt, and they went towards him. He's slashing at them. That Polish guy, Lukasz, he will suffer permanent pain on his left side from just the guy slashing with the machetes. The other guys went after him. I don't know what state their wounds are or whatever. But that is interesting. It's at odds with everything the British state has told us. It's at odds with all their stupid programs of de-radicalization. It's at odds with Sadiq Khan saying just get used to being blown up every so often. It's at odds with everything everyone who matters in the United Kingdom has said. And in some small way, it shows that people, at a certain point, the old survival instinct, or not even the survival instinct, but a kind of broader kind of heroism asserts itself. Mark F. says from Colorado, too stupid to survive indeed. I read today that a request by Navy instructors in Pensacola to arm themselves has been denied. Yeah, that's true. You belong to the most lavishly funded military on the planet. Doubling down on the existing stupid is part of the extinction plan, as Mark puts it. And Mark is right there. You belong to the most lavishly funded military on the planet with the biggest bases and the most weapons. And yet when some guy goes Allahu Akbar in there, you're supposed to just sit there and get shot while someone dials 911 for the local sheriff's department and they get you. These bases are huge, huge. And you're supposed to just wait for the sheriff to arrive, too. It's outrageous and disgraceful. We've got lots of great questions from Michelle Dulac and Corky Shibley and Lawrence Brennan and Michael Cavino and Deborah McKenzie that we didn't get to. And so we'll try and round those up. And we'll get to them in a video mailbox. Oh, and Kate Smythe from down in Sydney. I'm glad Kate at least is prompt and up and about. What is it now in Sydney? It's 9 a.m. So a little post-breakfast, but Kate's up and about. And with Kate in mind, Pooh Bear says, you need to say 8 a.m. tomorrow or Thursday for people in Australia because we live in the future, you live in the past. I try always to do that in the when I say 4 p.m. tomorrow, Wednesday, which is 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. I try to do that every time, Pooh Bear, which means that it's Thursday. But at any rate, I know it's Thursday in Australia and New Zealand. I bet you Kate already knows the result of the UK general election, but she just can't tell us because they've already... It's probably Friday by now. I've been yakking so long. I've overrun a little. So it's 5 p.m. North American Eastern Time on Wednesday. When we started this show, it was Thursday in Australia. But I bet by the Chatham, in the Chatham Islands at least, it must be Friday by now. Anyway, that is it. We've overrun a little. But I will get to all those great questions by Kate Smythe and Timothy McDonald and Michael Seth and all the other fine questions. And we'll try and pick them up in a video mailbox in the next couple of days. But that has been a rollicking Clubland Q&A, and I thank you very much. And do get out and vote. If you are one of our many listeners in the United Kingdom, do get out and vote wherever you live in the awesome foursome, as Boris amusingly called it, England, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, wherever you live in the awesome foursome, do get out and vote. And I don't think I need to say that in the United States because I'll say one final thing about impeachment. If you wanted to devise a way to energize the Trump base, impeach the guy. And they're stuck on it now. They're going to have a vote on impeachment. And if they do that, there's going to be a trial in the Senate. And all those stages, as we begin an election year, are going to dramatically energize the Trump base, and on the evidence of Rachel Maddow's dismal ratings, they ain't doing anything for the Democrat base. And that's my final thought. It's always a great pleasure to do these things. We've got a lot of stuff. Oh, before we go, I should let you know, if you're not a member of the Mark Steyn Club, there's lots of good things. Friday, we're starting our... We do this every Christmas season, starting a couple of years ago when I read A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. I did a rather creditable job, as I think of it. And we always do those at Christmas time. We always have a few seasonal stories for you. And this year's seasonal stories and tales for our time start on Friday. You can find all the other ones at our Tales for Our Time homepage. We hope you'll be with us for that. And then I think the following weekend, we will be airing this year's Mark Steyn Christmas show with Randy Bachman, the rock colossus of the Guess Who and Bachman Turner Overdrive, American Woman, You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, Taking Care of Business. Randy's going to be along. Orson Bean will be doing a bit of a Christmas Carol. Tal Bachman will be doing that with Orson. And Tal is Randy's son. And Tal, in that sense, is sort of collateral damage in this Peloton ad thing that's been going on that I talked about with Tucker, because his song is actually used in that ad. Tal will be with us on the Christmas show. Oh, two of my favorite jazz artists, Carol Welsman and Russell Malone. You're not going to miss, you won't want to miss them. Marla Shaffel, my chum, who's in one of my cat videos, Broadway, Tony nominated actress, great leading lady. Anthony Kearns from the Irish Tenors, absolutely beautiful voice. Got all kinds of other stuff in the Christmas show too. So it's an hour of caroling and comedy, and I hope you'll join us for that. We'd love to have you in the Mark Stein Club. And if you're short of Christmas ideas, it makes the perfect stocking stuffer. And it's an even nicer stocking stuffer when you enclose a gift membership with a copy of my delightful Christmas album with Miss Jessica Martin, Making Spirits Bright. Because nothing will make your spirits brighter on Christmas morning than me and Jessica singing the Christmas Glowworm, which is, and actually Marshmallow World. If I do so myself, that's the all-time great Christmas record. And nuts to anyone who thinks otherwise. That's it from us. We will see you next time.